So why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself, Nick? Yeah. What should I call you? Nick Nicholas?
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
Nick is probably easier.
Okay.
That's tricky. Where do I start? I live in Santa Cruz.
Oh, really?
I'm not too far from you. I'll be trying to come to the San Jose meetup here in about a week.
Oh, good. I have a son who goes to UC Santa Cruz.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. It's a pretty town.
It is. Definitely is.
Expensive place to live, I bet.
It is. Very much so. A little too much, I would say.
My wife and I drive in there, it's like, oh, we should buy a house, and then we pull up Zillow and it's like, ooh.
maybe a shack.
I'm gonna grab my water bottle here because I'm fighting a cold, and so it helps keep my throat wet.
Nice.
So
it just went around really bad around here a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
Laid out most of the town.
It's a pretty laid out town to begin with.
Yeah. Any added stress is definitely too much for Santa Cruz.
So when did you, I assume you found Jordan Peterson before me, which seems to be the way of most things. So.
Maybe I found him. When did I find him? I feel like, it was probably from Joe Rogan that I first came across him, that first interview he did. And then I started digging through his lecture videos, which was, I don't know, October, November, sometime around the end of last year. Yeah, and when I found him, I was just coming out of a cult.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I've got quite a unintentional history with cults, it seems, which is peculiar because I generally am a very, like, I don't know what the right word is, individualistic person. I kind of have a lot of faith in my own ability to understand and interpret things. Mm-hmm. And yet I repeatedly find myself in situations like this. But yeah, that was actually the fourth cult, technically, I had been part of. In a vague sense, that was the first one that I actually chose and consciously partook in, whereas the others were kind of like minor, more normal bait and switch type of situation.
Okay.
You know, I had, when I was young, I think 18, maybe I think 19 actually, I kind of started looking for alternative lifestyles, particularly within the, man, this headphone has given me some problems. Mm. Particularly within the kind of green movement and the homesteading movement. So I went about trying to learn how to homestead. And ironically, it seems most people that homestead, or at least are willing to teach it, are actually cults. Good warning for those out there.
That's interesting.
I'm joking there, but I seem to particularly have attracted those types of situations. So yeah, that whole bit of my history started when I was going through the Woofing program, which is Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. And so I figured that it's basically a work trade scenario where farms will put up ad listings. And then it's basically you work on the farm for some period of time and a certain number of hours per week. And then they give you something in return. And it's usually just lodging and, maybe I can do this without this headphone.
Someone who came, he and his wife were on a kind of a cross country trip, and then they came to Living Stones one Sunday, and they were going to basically swap a little bit of labor for a free night stay.
Yes.
And they found it a very, we, of course it was only one place that they stopped, but they said, boy, never again.
That's I think the scenario is, like, you know, there are definitely just farms that you can find through those types of situations that are just looking for cheap labor. But it's also like the perfect situation for people that are doing more than just farms to, spread their message.
Wow.
And it didn't help, you know, I was coming out of a very strong teenage atheist phase, like the very classic, I've got it all figured out and, you know, it's all material and that whole thing. And, you know, around the age of 18, I started realizing, like, oh, wait a second, there's a lot of experiences and, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't fit in this worldview that I can't, you know, process with using it. Or if I do process it, it ends up just being this dull, flat, very unsatisfying way to view.
I haven't experienced it, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly.
Me
exactly.
And my 18 years on this planet.
Oh, yeah.
Just saying.
Oh, yeah. I had it all figured out. And I am, you know, I have always had a lot of faith in my own intelligence. Not that sounds oxymoronic, but it is not. Which I've certainly humbled throughout the years now that I think about. You know, you can only mess up so many times before you start wondering, like, maybe there's something a little...
maybe I shouldn't be in charge of myself. Maybe I'm not a good captain of my own ship.
Certainly. Well, and it's ironic because, it's a very... stark contrast between my kind of, again, I kind of default towards that dull, I'm the master of my own, you know, and then it gets to the points where it's just too much, there's too much built up that I haven't been able to process, and then it kind of bursts out in a big motion. Hence, for instance, at 19, taking off to Hawaii to go work on a random farm and learn, whatever I thought I was going to learn there. So, of course, I picked an ad that was like meditation and retreat center with organic farming, and it sounded great and all that stuff. And when we got there, it ended up being a group of Hare Krishnas that actually had a massive network. So, I mean, like, certainly a few hundred people were involved, and they had kind of taken over the whole part of the island. This is the big island out in Pahoa, which is like it's like the Wild West out there. Like, I backpacked through Europe when I was 18 by myself and went and did all that stuff. Nowhere I went in Europe felt as foreign as this area of Hawaii. It's a really bizarre place. And it's where the lava flow is. So basically, the problem is that no insurance companies or utility companies will put anything out there because they're worried that the lava is going to change direction and just wipe it out. And they don't want to. So the only people that live out there are people that are willing to do so with like minimal utilities, and right, water catchment is the main way anyone has any water to work with. And it usually attracts people running from the law because there's just none out there, you know? And then it's a weird place. It's a really weird place. So that was the base for the Hare Krishnas, which in itself is like, and I can kind of get into this. I kind of have a philosophy at this point that everything is actually cults, that the fundamental mode of human society is cultic, right? And that kind of gets into that. You ask the question, what does a cult do for a person? Well, there's the surface level, kind of like it offers community and you know, group adhesion and those types of things, right? I almost think of the word cult as like the particle that makes up culture, right? It's the smaller version that then...
That's good. I like that.
And so when you ask the question, what's it doing for people, I'd say its main function is to make the world digestible, able to be consumed, right? Because without any cultic framework, we're just kind of lost in an amorphous experience of life that has no context or inherent meaning. And that's tricky, right? To actually play with those dynamics all the way, just because we're such a social creature, you'd have to imagine a person that had no socialization whatsoever and what they're interpreting as the world, which has actually happened. There's been feral humans and they don't develop in the way they're not almost not human in the way that we think of humans. It diverts back towards something more like a very smart monkey. No offense to the feral humans out there.
Well, there's the feral human cohort of my following that I'll write them a letter, say maybe they should skip this video. The feral humans on YouTube. But I think that's an awesome observation. That I think that's really helpful. You know, a lot of the Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris conversation got into this a priori framework, which part of it is hardware, but a lot of it's software. And we're very mysterious creatures. And for being us, we'd think we'd know ourselves better, and we clearly don't.
No, not at all. Not at all. And that's kind of, in the process, what's it mean to make the world digestible? Well, it's not necessarily just in the mimetic realm, right? That's, and I think Jordan Peterson has got into this before too, where we've got the memes and then we've got the genes, and the relationship between the two of them is not nearly as cut and dry as we would like to perhaps imagine.
Right. I think that's very true.
Yes, and a lot of it is like we can't actually get down to our own hardware, and it's almost like we're stuck in a mimetic complex where the hardware itself is what is producing the mimetic framework, and so there's not a good way that we can actually untie ourselves from any mimetic that even that statement means nothing to a human from where we normally operate from. You're always operating within it. You know, the most basic, one of the most basic levels is just language, which is, pretty extreme, possession. Right, we become possessed by language to the point that we can't operate not using language. And then there's religious movements that basically try and allow you to get underneath, the language that our mind is constantly using to interpret everything. And then of course the structure of the language and how we go about it goes on forever. But I forgot what my original point with another interesting observation is just, when you start kind of, particularly when you get into our postmodern context, this kind of post-truth world, and, what does it mean
for... I'm still listening. Hang on. I got to get a cough drop. I can still hear you. My cord is big.
Cool. what does it mean for a Oh, darn. I keep losing my train of thought. I've got all this nervous energy. I'm not used to talking like this. It keeps throwing me off. Makes the world digestible. Oh, darn. I forgot where I was going with it. Well, I'll go back to the story and then maybe the idea will come back around. So yeah, show up at on the Big Island of Hawaii with a bag and two guitars. I don't know why I brought two guitars when I didn't have a car or anything. So I'm walking like miles a day to get around the area. it was a very silly.
With two guitars.
Situation, yeah.
Very minimalist.
Like a big hard case. Yeah, yeah, classical and a steel string. Very. Do bizarre things when you're 19 and trying to figure out life. So we get there, and of course we find out that it's not just a meditation, you know, a kind of non-religious meditation.
It's not non-denominational.
Yes, it's very denominational. And we try, you know, thankfully two people, I went with a friend of mine, and two people showed up the day before we got there that had done the same thing, where they just randomly decided to go do this woofing program at this place. And so the four of us kind of grouped up, and one of the guys from the other group was borrowing his friend's car. So we had some amount of transportation once we had kind of all linked up and everything, which made the whole situation a lot better. But you can very easily see how people that, you know, had kind of put everything on the line to get out there in the first place then would become stuck within the system because it's their only means to, you know, have anything to eat or have a place to sleep. And there were certainly people like that there. Mm. So we ended up only sticking around for about 2 or 3 weeks. We kept getting into arguments with the people, and I kind of took, you know, I like to go in and deconstruct systems. It's fun. It's like a game to me. And so I was kind of like poking around and trying to find the inconsistencies and all that kind of stuff. And it drove them nuts. And
I love this story. This is an awesome story.
It's very,
I can just see it.
Very, very strange set of experiences I've had.
Not all. I mean, I was a missionary in the Dominican Republic, and we'd have people come down and because they were looking for whatever, and they would roll. I lived in a little town towards the end of the world, in a sense, and the most interesting people would come and live there. And because if there were hardly any North Americans living there, so you'd all get to know, you'd all find each other pretty quickly. And
yeah.
Oh, it was just
reasons.
Yeah.
you get the really weird cultures in those places. No one else wants to, or not wants to necessarily, but just no one else goes.
Yeah.
You know, this spot in Hawaii was probably more along the lines of wants to because of the constant threat of being wiped out by a volcano, but it's like all of the energy, you know, ambient energy was just pushed through the roof there. You know, you had like the volcano going off right there, the freaking rainforest, the jungle just shooting up out of the ground. You had the Pacific Ocean, like, you know, there within view at all times. All of the elements were just so big, and you could see it like driving people crazy. You know, it was too much.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a weird place. you know. So eventually we basically got kicked out of that place. And what we did is we rented a shack in the jungle. We were staying at a noni farm in an abandoned school bus for a couple weeks. That's, you know, we were trying to get away from the home base of the, of, you know.
It's Chris McCandless in Paradise.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
The Into the Wild guy, you know, who died up there in Alaska.
Yes.
But at least it's warm.
Warm. It's a lot harder to die. There's a lot more food too. It just kind of falls out of everything. Stayed at the Noni farm for a while, basically trying to separate ourselves from the group to see if we could like still make it work, just doing the farming work with less of the religious influence. And it's not, you know, it's not to say like a group of people practicing a religion was the problem. It was a lot more of how they specifically had it structured, which was extremely dictatorial and like, you know, a hierarchy that was really rigid in its command line.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we get out, we end up renting a shack in the jungle with nothing, no electricity, no running water. There was a water catchment system that we had been using for weeks before we found out it was infested with mosquito larvae. So we had just been like brushing our teeth and cooking with it. You know, we never drank it straight because it's not safe. You have to heat the water up. But we had to sleep in a tent inside the shack because it was infested with cockroaches. So camping inside the building. It was very silly. During that time, I ended up starting to date the girl that had come with the other dude. They weren't together, but like, so it was three guys, one girl. I got the girl.
Oh. And
so the other two dudes took off with the car. So, and they said they were going hiking for the weekend, and like a week later, we're like, we still haven't heard anything. 2 weeks later, they finally sent us a message saying, you know, we're not coming back, and we still have the car. And so at this point, you know, we were about 4 or 5 miles away from the town when we were with the Krishnas, but this shack in the jungle, this, and it was owned by one of the main Krishna guys. He owned thousands of acres. He just bought up all of the land no one wanted and then put up all these shitty, no, sorry, not good structures. So you basically you took the highway out from the town about 9 miles, and then you hit a sign that just says end of the road. And it's where the volcano back in the 80s, the lava flow just wiped out an entire city and the highway that took you out there. So then you'd walk across, you know, I don't know, a few hundred yards of lava, and then the highway would reappear. And then when you saw a bread tree, which is a distinct fruit, it's like a giant spiky fruit, you turned right into the jungle and walked back for about a mile and hoped you found the shack. And that's where we lived. So it was about 10 miles from town and we didn't have a car. And because you're so far out at that end of the road place, no one ever drives out there. So you'd have to walk usually about 5 or 6 miles until you were close enough that there was neighborhoods and traffic so that you could hitch a ride the rest of the way. We stayed there for the remainder of the month, and it was just too difficult. We paid $200 to rent it for the month. So we, you know, had to...
And the dude got money out of you too.
Oh yeah, definitely. And then we moved to a place called Cinderland. So one of the recruitment strategies the Krishnas had was a food party dance, because they would do the kirtan, where they are singing and dancing in front of the statues, and it's a whole production. And then they'd have a giant meal, and they would feed whoever would come to the thing. And that was every Saturday. So this other place was basically just a hippie commune called Cinderland. They called themselves a eco-village. And we slept under a tarp, so we didn't have walls anymore, but there also wasn't cockroaches or anything, so it was actually like an upgrade. There's a really big, like, giant mesh tarps, not like the tarp you'd get at, you know, Home Depot or whatever. And then you just had a mosquito net over your bed, and that was pretty much that, you know, just gravel on the ground. And we stayed there for I think a month and a half. I was on the island for a total of 4 months, so I kind of forget how the time broke down. But and that was actually a lot more fun. There was nothing productive going on at all. Oh, on Saturdays, to compete with the Krishnas, they'd have a pot pizza party. So they would do all this cannabis cooking and then invite all the hippies to come have a drum circle in the under a tarp. It's a very, very strange place.
Oh, wow. Wow.
We stayed there for a month. Lots of really weird stories from that place. It's like all of the normal dramas you normally encounter in life, but they're all like times 100 out there.
Yeah. Yep.
I got my first acupuncture there because I helped a dude pay for his groceries. His name was Thunder, and my first acupuncture was given to me by Thunder laying on the ground on a pallet. And that was really intense. He put the needles all the way through my feet, in between the bones of my feet, because he said it was like a grounding thing to pull the energy out. So that gave me a really negative view of acupuncture. Like laying there with my eyes closed, just trying not to have like a full panic. Like I couldn't move or stand or anything because I had the needles in my feet. Waiting it out. Don't get acupuncture in the middle of nowhere by a guy named Thunder. Another good piece of advice. If that's not obvious. Stayed there for a month and a half. 9 years later, so like a year and a half ago or something. I'm 29. There's a guy that was doing a series of like kind of hour-long documentaries on various cults that he would find and go explore and see what their system was. Well, Cinderland was one of the ones he went to go explore. So when I was there, I just thought it was an eco-village with, you know, it's just a silly hippie place to hang out and, you know. Ends up that's not the case, and that the main guy who was gone when I was there called himself Jesus with a Z, G-E-Z-U-S.
No relation to Kanye.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. Wondering where Kanye got his inspiration. Jesus the Cinderland, and so it ends up the giant tarps we were all sleeping under were actually supposed to be sails for an ark. And what had happened is that Jesus had
a revelation,
thank you, that global warming was going to cause the sea levels to rise so dramatically that he was going to build an ark, right? Typical Noah's Flood reworking. He was going to build an ark, which 9 years later, they were actually doing, like building this wooden contraption out of like palm trees. And, you know, it was about 20 feet long, not quite big enough to restart the world. But the tarps we were sleeping under were actually intended to be sails for this ark. And he was going to, when the flood happened, sail his ark from the big island of Hawaii to Machu Picchu in South America, which would then be at sea level. And then he would restart humanity with his little cult there.
He had a plan. See?
So that was cult number two. Yes, he definitely had a plan.
Good. So good for Jesus with a Z.
Yes, Jesus with a Z. Yeah, so that was number two. Granted, when I was there, he wasn't, and it was just a pretty basic little goofy hippie commune.
You missed Jesus and just got the disciples. Too bad.
Right? and then number three came about 2 years later. So the same friend I went to Hawaii with, and then, you know, he had split ways and gone with the other guy that had the car, and we hadn't talked for like a year, and then we kind of warmed back up to each other and we're hanging out a couple years later. He had a wife now and a daughter once he had come back. And he remembered a teacher that had given a kind of new agey lecture about love, and he had this whole system of how it all works and how the religious symbolism works, and he found it really interesting. So he contacted this guy and found out that he had a permaculture setup. So we're still trying to learn, like, you know, basic homesteading skills through this whole experience. And so he sets up to go basically learn permaculture from this guy. and so he goes out there with his wife and his like 2-year-old daughter. This is Idaho. We were living in the Pacific Northwest, so it wasn't too big of a jump. It was up on the panhandle. Can't remember the name of the town. Man, it's really raining. If you can't tell, I seem to have a thing for shack-like spaces. I can touch the ceiling.
I don't see a tent, though. It can't be too bad.
It's upgrades, right? It's the tent's out back. Kidding. So we go to this. He shows up a week before I do. I'm having phone conversations with him, and it's like I can tell something's weird, but he won't say what. He just is like really wanting me to come like right now, which I don't understand why or like what is. So I get there, the old guy and his wife, it ends up, you know, we were there for about a week before we got the whole story, or I was. Ends up, he was a failed cult leader. So at one point, his whole permaculture setup had about 20 people working it. And his whole thing was that he believed that planet Nibiru was going to fly past the Earth any year now. So classic doomsday. Another interesting quality of cults. Actually, an interesting quality of culture in general is doomsday. Like, yeah. The only reason anyone does anything is because of doomsday. The entire green movement is not like, let's reconnect with the earth. It's, we have to, or it's going to die. Like, it always has that undertone, which kind of threw me for a long time. Like, why is that such a prevalent notion in seemingly every culture that we encounter? And then I started thinking, well, it's probably us projecting death, which is to say, no matter what, like, right, life ends in an apocalypse.
That's right.
Now, it might be a personal one, but it's no less, we still have to grapple with that same structure. And so we have this way of mythologizing it and then using that to be able to process the experience of death. And thus you end up with all cultures in some way having some basis of an apocalyptic, you know, that's my guess, at least.
I think it's a good guess. I think it's true. I often, when I teach about the Day of the Lord in the Old Testament, I mean, the Day of the Lord is a very interesting device because it's the fall, it's the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, it's a plague of locusts, it's the crucifixion, it's the resurrection, it's Judgment Day, it's all those things. They're all the Day of the Lord. And it comes to each one of us personally. It comes to every institution. It comes to every household. It comes to the whole world. I think you're right on.
The interesting thing is seeing what people do with it and how they structure it.
Yeah. Right?
And that's a good example, is you have so many elements to it within the Christian mythos where you can't almost, you can't quite parse it into some simpler form. It's sitting on a paradox in a sense, right? That's another part of my cult theories, is that one of the main features of a powerful cult is that it has the ability to process a paradox.
Hmm.
Now, process is tricky because it's more like it allows us to experience a paradox rather than like make sense of it with our mind. You know, Christ's crucifixion and resurrection, or even the figure of Christ at all as God incarnate, those are central paradoxes that fundamentally don't make sense to our conscious mind, but they hit some perceptual system underneath it, right? They change the way that we are actually experiencing life, or that's ideally its function. And, you know, cults that can't deal with paradoxes usually are very short-termed. And part of that, too, is that when you can process a single paradox, it kind of gives you a lens that you can use then to interpret all incoming information. And that's really necessary, because if you don't have something like that, your cognitive dissonance starts to build, right? As new experiences coming in, it can't transfer over into a processed bit of your network fast enough. And we start feeling dissonance. Mm-hmm. When that dissonance peaks a threshold, the person will jump cults. They'll go find another interpretation that reduces the cognitive dissonance back below their threshold. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking at really powerful interpretive systems, they generally need some way to be able, I would actually say it's probably their most useful, or I can't think of the word, their base function is being able to actively interpret life as it is happening, mm-hmm. you know? And I would argue that's like what religion is also trying to get us to do, right? We go back to these old stories and make sense of them and figure out all these hidden intricacies hiding in the stories. And all of this is kind of building up a skill set so that we can symbolically interpret life as it's happening, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I think we end up in issues when we either stick too strongly to the past, which is like we don't see it as a skill. We see it as a isolated truth locked at some point in history, mm-hmm. rather than as a truth that can be experienced, you know, actively within our own
mm-hmm.
Experience.
I think that's really good. It's really helpful.
Maybe.
No, I think there's a lot there that's really true. Because because you're exactly right. I mean, the world is just too, it's manifestly complex that we can't process it. And so, and part of that is paradox. And in fact, that's what you know, you might think of religions kind of like enzymes, and they help break these down. Now, they don't explain them away, but they do allow you to hold them. At least
it allows you to actually add it to yourself and then change your expression through the, you know, it's,
yes,
the analogy to consumption is like a really good one. You
know, yeah.
You can't do anything with an apple.
Right.
Until you break it into pieces. And then that process of breaking it down and synthesizing it with your body is what produces the energy needed to actually do all this stuff.
Right. Part of the reason we can't process most leaves is that we have a friend who's a biochemical engineer in Iowa, and he says, well, we lack this enzyme. And so, you know, one of the things he was working on is creating biofuel. And so he uses these enzymes and breaks things down. And
interesting.
And I think you're right. Cult, religion, they break this stuff down and into a productive package that we can actually
use.
That's right. Yeah. No, I think it's a terrifically helpful observation. I really appreciate that.
And the other part of that too, this is the old thought that I forgot a while back now, is we kind of are at the point, right? This postmodern frame that we imagine as being, well, post, like current.
Yep.
I don't think it's actually current. I think it's what happens any time two cultures try and synthesize. Now, we can synthesize cultures. It's just that normally the consumption rate is really slow. So, for example, you know, the spread of Rome, right? A large part of its collapse was this inability to hold all of these cultures within a single framework, where it tried to synthesize too much, right? It's trying to eat an elephant in one bite.
Right.
Like you have to cut it up into the pieces, right. And then, you know, you might be able to eat an elephant, but you certainly won't be able to do it all at once.
Right.
So the trick with the modern, the current age is just that effect is overpowering. We can't escape it because for every event, you see 1,000 opinions around it.
Right.
That are all a specific cultural lens, and we don't know how to synthesize all of those viewpoints at once. So what we end up having to do is isolate our ability to do so into a pretty tight cultic bubble. And then that's the other interesting bit, is that we know this is that we're living in a cultic world, because whoever we look at that's not in our cult, we think they're in a cult. Right? Like, it seems silly to not take that one step further and go, oh, wait, I'm probably also part of
this. I'm in a cult.
Yeah. But we defend ourselves from it from this idea of some objective truth. And that's what the concept of objective truth has traditionally
right.
done.
Right.
You know, an objective is a bit.
You have what I call the monarchical vision. You have the monarchical.
Yes.
You see the world clearly, and so in a lot of ways, people who say deconverted from Christianity, they would use metaphors like I was stepping out of the room into the bright light of day. I mean, that's kind of a way to represent. You know, now I see.
Clearly, I see the cult I was in, whereas
right.
before I just thought it was the world.
Right. Without recognizing that you're still in a world.
Yes.
And
yeah.
But
yeah.
you don't, you have no
can't
culture.
Get out of
you
them.
No
you're in, it's like a Russian doll problem. You
right.
know?
Right. Right.
Break one open, you're just in another. And I think that's actually like a main part of this whole thing, is like, instead of trying to always escape our cults, that granted it does have some use, right? Science is kind of like that's its whole thing, is the cult breaker. And then
right,
ironically,
right.
it ends up recreating the same thing in the process of trying to escape it.
Right. No, that's really good. And, you know, because one of the things, you know, I hope to talk to James Lindsay, who's part of the Boghossian, Lindsay, Pluckrose trio who wrote the hoax papers. And Peter Boghossian was a big, he wrote a manual for creating atheists. And so they've been, he's been big into this, you know, science. And what do they discover? But, oh my goodness, there's a religion out there.
It's getting.
Surprise! I'm shocked there's a religion. Shocked have you. Oh, here's my winnings. You know.
Yeah.
But all life is religion. I mean, it's, I think you're really helpful. This is really good.
And so I guess the final part of this is like, instead of trying to escape the cults or make one seem like the real one and the rest are just deluded people, it makes more sense to embrace that aspect and then from there go forward through a pragmatic game. Right? So they're not all created equal. Some cults have the ability to process much better and much more meaningfully than others. And so I, this gets big, but I think this is inevitably where humanity must go because of our modes of production, right? So you have the tangible age, which is most human history, you know, up until the peak of the tangible age happens at the Industrial Revolution. And then we enter into the intangible age, the age of thought and ideas. And right now, America's economy is mostly based off of the production of intangible goods. Interestingly, you also see a major shift in how we symbolize value in the world with that as well, right? All of human history up until the intangible age, money is represented by a physical good, a precious metal usually, but also beads or shells or, right? Some limited resource that you can hand to somebody else. With the intangible age, that system could not function because thoughts move way faster than physical objects. Right? So that's when you see the rise of fiat currencies suddenly pop up. And what is a fiat currency? Well, it's functioning in this intangible realm. It's not tied to anything in the actual world. It's largely functioning on belief. Fiat itself means, I think, an arbitrary order. So you're just, right? I think that we will see a third age coming, which would be, you know, the untangible age. And that this untangible is not dealing in the realm of ideas, but in the underlying structure that that ideas come out of, which is that cultic structure, right? And I think that the intangible age will peak at the development of AI, which will leave humans very little room to go anywhere else to have something to trade in. I think that can be symbolized in a number of ways. One might call it like trading in our experience of being alive, rather than necessarily our interpretation of it, although it all is tied together. You know, you can't divorce the realms. And I think we're already seeing this. I think that's what social media is. And right, even the concept of celebrity is changing from someone who's good at something to someone who just enjoys being alive. Right, we follow them just because we want to see their experience of life itself,
right?
Not because they're the smartest or they're the fast or whatever.
We participate in their experience of being alive.
Yes, yes, exactly. Right now, there's no value structure for that. And so what we're doing is we're backwards translating it into the tangible. So the only way it becomes valued is by selling ad space. I think once we make the jump to actually valuing it itself, we'll see this automatic, pragmatic game of cults arise, and it will be actually exposed to Jeez. My roommate's coughing. I don't know if you can pick that up.
No, I don't hear him.
Okay. exposed to economic pressures, right? Open market pressures. And I think that that's actually a really good thing, particularly when we don't have our hierarchy inverted, where the untangible, or right, other, the soul, right? That part of life that doesn't, you can't quite capture other than by being alive.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. yeah, I think that we will, that direct market pressures will create a system that is really very good for people. Oh, and when it's not in service to the tangible, I think that's what's making it so gross at the moment.
Hmm.
This kind of hidden manipulation in how the whole system is functioning that we're not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see, you know, it could also go the other way and be terrible, or it could turn into some type of, like, you know, the government is the truth, right? All the classic cultic things that pop up when the ground gets a little mushy.
Yeah.
And this is, this connects again to Peterson, because that's a large part of his argument, is like Christianity isn't where it's at because of manipulations of power systems. It's where it's at because it's one of the best games around.
Right.
So I think it can only do good to have these things kind of compete in a open, in a marketplace.
Yeah.
You know, fundamentally. Yeah. I mean, they always kind of have. It's just we haven't actually valued it or stuck value judgments on it.
And part of what I was just talking to an Orthodox father a little bit earlier this morning, and you know, one of the interesting things is how the American context changes the Orthodox Church, because the Orthodox Church comes from the old world. Yeah. State established churches. The crazy thing about America with its religious freedom is that there is very much a market.
Yes, definitely.
And that, you know, in terms of Christianity, that happened to Protestantism and just whoosh. And then you get, you know, the Mormons, the Jehovah's Witnesses. I mean, and it just flies. And you see the same thing with Eastern, with Buddhism, with Hinduism. They kind of become New Age, which is highly market oriented to the point of, you know, Hare Krishna cult is extremely market oriented.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
They learn to use the market in strange new ways.
Yeah.
So, boy, I wish we had more time, but this was so cool. This was so cool. Well, and I really hope you're able to make it down to San Jose to the meetup, because
absolutely,
because a bunch of the guys who will come down with me to the meetup, they're going to watch this. They're going to want to meet you.
Excellent. Yeah, I will definitely make it over. It's I remember, or in the email exchange, you said that, and I was like really excited because I've been wanting to make it to one of the Sacramento ones for a while now. And it just, I haven't been able to get, like, it's the drive back that makes me like not.
Well, I've been, because again, my son goes to UC Santa Cruz, so I know that drive.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, it's a drive.
It's a drive.
Up over the mountain. And
but
we're actually not too far from the Santa Cruz, you know, that we're in San Jose, quite close to.
I know, you're right on. I looked at the location. Yeah. You're right on the other side of the 17 there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Basically Los Gatos.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's perfect.
Yeah. Well, boy, I sure do. I have permission to post this, because this has been.
Absolutely.
It's just been ecstatic. I mean, the stories and the ideas, this has been, you know, the sum of all.
It's like a shotgun shot trying to get it out. Normally I'm a little more organized, but
no, it was perfect. There's narrative and you know, as someone who say critiques sermons and helps people craft things, this fell together really nicely. So
awesome.
So I'll probably post this one today. So cool. Well, it's great to meet you, Nick.
Absolutely. It's great to finally talk to you. I've watched so many hours of your content. It's really interesting to actually interact. I feel like I'm, yeah, there's some weird meta layer going on
here. Yeah, well, I think you've colonized. I think some of your ideas have colonized in me, and they're going to keep working. And so if you start hearing some of your ideas come out there, don't sue me.
I stole them all, so.
Well, I did too, so we're all a bunch of thieves. Well, great talking to you, Nick. And again, I hope to see you on the 22nd.
Awesome. Sounds good. Great to talk to you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.